се, дърсе, тавела гре. Лей, флаша! Отпри, отпри!
Съм флаширан и дух. Пресничил вам обом едно желио.
Да би се море спременило у ирски пир.
Ирска. О ирских джоких пиво вискию, о ирских сетрих и на усам ирском, у ресних одаях о ирски.
Клинт патака желя, здай бова могла паучонстат.
Приложност замујена не врне се нобена е проект Радија Студент, ки открива спремембе у манших државах по нихови уклучитви у Европско унијо. Држава првега обиска, очитно Ирска.
Проекти подпрла делегација Европске комисије у Словенији.
Irsko kot deželo navzven odlikujejo predvsem zelena gričevnata pokrajina, po kateri se podijo številne črede ovac, deževno podnebje, dobro pivo, prijazni ter odprti domačini in pa njihove stare legende o malih in nagajivi škratih, ki poznajo poti do skritih zakladov. Samo ujeti jih morate. Ključ do poznavanja kulture prebivalcev tega zelenega otoka v Atlantiku leži v razumevanju njihove dolge, bogate, a tudi trpke zgodovine, ki so jo krvavo zaznamovala stoletja spopadov, osvajanj in uporov. Irsko zgodovino so najprej krojila keltska plemena, ki so se na otok preselila iz Anglije in celine okoli 400 let pred našim štetjem. V 5. stoletju našega štetja so na Irsko prispeli kristijani in pod vodstvom svetega Patrika med tedanjim prebivalstvom začeli širiti krščanstvo. Otok, prej odrezan od ostale Evrope, je v nekaj naslednjih stoletjih postal evropsko kulturno središče. Kljub temu pa so se prva mesta začela postavljati šele, ko so prišli vikingi. Ti so na Irsko prispeli v poznem 8. stoletju. Leta 1169 so se v spore med vikinškimi feudalci umešali normani iz Walesa, ki so po dveletnih spopadih zavzeli večino otoka in priznali angleškega kralja Henrika II. Za vladarja Irske. Samo še na zahodni obali so se ohranile neodvisne keltske kneževine. Popolna angleška nadvlada se je začela v 16. stoletju, ko je takratni kralj Henrik IX. Normanskim plemičem oduzel vso oblast, si podredil še zadnjega irskega kneza in na vsem otoku uvedel angleško feudalno ureditev ter upravo. Množično priseljevanje Angležev je povzročilo veliko uporov, ki pa so bili vsakič krvavo in srdito zatrti. Protestantska nadvlada se je še bolj utrdila v 17. stoletju, ko so Angleži zatrli veliki irski upor. Vsem upornikom so bila zasežena njihova posestva, katoličani pa so bili nasplošno preganjeni in skoraj v celoti izključeni iz javnega življenja. Stoletje in pol kasneje so člani irskega parlamenta od kralja zahtevali in tudi dobili večjo avtonomijo, vendar je kmalu zatem Irska vseeno dokončno postala sestavni del Združenega kraljestva Velike Britanije. Eden izmed največjih dogodkov, ki so zaznamovali novejšo irsko zgodovino, je bila strašna lakota, ki se je pripetila na polovici 19. stoletja. Zaradi nje je v nekaj letih umrlo 800 tisoč prebivalcev, medtem ko sta se 2 milijona ljudi izselila, v glavnem v ZDA in Zahodno Evropo. V tem času se je okrepila irska narodna zavest, ki je sprožila predvsem večji odpor proti britanski oblasti. Irska je bila tako že takrat razcepljena na severni protestantski del in na južni del, ki je bil v rokah katoliških republikancev. Tako je še danes. Zaradi dejstva, da je irska zgodovina prepletena z najprej medplemenskimi in kasneje z nacionalnimi ter religijskimi konflikti, mnogi danes Ircem prehitro pripisujejo, da so predvsem potomci Keltov, Vikingov in Normanov. Iz tega sledijo zmotne stereotipne oznake, da so Irci hitro vzkipljivi in razborit narod. O teh stereotipih smo se pogovarjali z irskim pisateljem, rojenim v Belfastu, Robertom Allenom.
Well, there is a stereotypical image, which is that the Irish are descendant from the waves of Celts that came over from Central Europe and also from the Vikings and the Norsemen that came down from Scandinavia and also from the Normans who came over from France and latterly the Anglo-Saxons that came over from England. So the modern Irish character is probably no different to the rest of the Western European character. There's certainly something in the Irish character that, as far as I'm concerned, is no longer Irish. So I think it's fair enough to say that the majority of the people that live in Ireland who can, if they can, trace their ancestry back might struggle to find themselves back towards the Celtic tribes. Now, the Celtic tribes themselves were no angels. They're depicted in a modern image as being sharing, cooperative, friendly, but they were just as aggressive and competitive as everyone else. So this image of the modern Irish character is a myth. The Irish are no different than anyone else in Western Europe, and you can see this if you travel around the place. So anybody that says that the modern Irish are this, well then is, and they're not being very scientific, but it doesn't really matter, for the simple reason is that there's been so much movement around Western Europe over the last 5,000 years that it's just one great melting pot. So nationality doesn't make an awful lot of difference anymore, and you can certainly see that in Ireland.
Boj za neodvisnost Irske se je začel proti koncu 19. stoletja s prvimi večjimi in uspešnejšimi poskusi za oživitev irskega jezika in kulture. Politično fronto je leta 1905 zagnalo gibanje Sinn Féin, kar prevedeno v slovenščino pomeni mi sami. Sinn Féin je leta 1916 sprožil tako imenovano velikonočno oboroženo vstajo v Dublinu, a so jo Britanci kmalu zadušili. Boj se je nadaljeval dve leti kasneje, ko je Sinn Féin ustanovil prvi neodvisni irski parlament in razglasil Irsko za neodvisno državo. Razglasitvi neodvisnosti je nemudoma sledila irsko-britanska vojna. Irska republikanska armada se je uspešno borila v vseh spopadih in s tem prisilila britanski parlament, da je leta 1920 Ircem priznal večjo avtonomijo. Otok se je tako dokončno razdelil na 26 neodvisnih provinc in na 6 provinc na severu, ki so ostale znotraj Velike Britanije. Ira je še vedno zahtevala popolno osamosvojitev vseh provinc, vendar pa so stvari kmalu ušle iz rok in začela se je državljanska vojna med zagovorniki avtonomije, večinskim katoliškim prebivalstvom, in nasprotniki avtonomije, protestanti na severu. Šele leta 1937 je neodvisna irska vlada pretrgala vse vezi z Veliko Britanijo in leta 1949 tudi uradno izstopila iz Commonwealtha. Po ustavi iz leta 1937 je Irska postala parlamentarna republika. Zaradi dejstva, da je 6 severnih provinc kljub vsemu ostalo v rokah Velike Britanije, je Ira nadaljevala oborožen upor proti britanskim okupatorjem. V zavest Ircev se je močno vtisnil tudi dogodek poimenovan Bloody Sunday ali Krvava nedelja, ko so britanski vojaki leta 1972 v Belfastu streljali na mirne protestnike in jih 13 ubili, veliko več pa ranili. Spopadi med katoličani in protestanti na severu so se začeli umirjati na prehodu v 21. stoletje s pogajanji med državama in prostovoljno razorožitvijo Ire. O današnjih odnosih med katoličani in protestanti na severu Irske in o starih zamerah nasploh nam bo podrobneje pojasnil Robert Allen.
There is a lot of intolerance there, but that intolerance comes an awful lot out of what would be best be described as post-colonialism, and every country in the world, I think there's 137 countries in the world that have been colonized, and every one of them shares the same kind of characteristics, whether they be India or whether they be Ireland. So again, this is a myth that the Irish dislike the English. They don't so much dislike the English. They probably dislike soldiers who wear any uniform and police who wear any uniform. But if they have a dislike, if they tend to be Republican or Nationalist, they will have a dislike of the British government of Westminster, because pretty much like everybody else does, when they colonize a place, they lie to people, they break treaties, they break promises. So, but this doesn't filter down really to the people, because the people are only really interested in what everyone's interested in, that is a roof over their head, clothes on their back, and warmth, shelter, and food. So any kind of antagonism that may exist towards the English would be simply because the English government or the British government doesn't provide these things. And certainly when I was there a few weeks ago, you could see that. A lot, I was asking about the factories in the different parts, and the factories are all closing down, so there's not a lot of work, and unemployment is rising. So therefore, that brings antagonism between the two Christian groups. And let's be clear about this. We are talking about two Christian groups. We're not talking about a set of Martians that have landed and decided they want to take over the indigenous people. We're talking about two groups of people who follow the same kind of religion, and there's very little difference between them. So there isn't really any antagonism towards the English in that sense. And as far as Republicans are concerned, well, Republicans aren't really that much different from anybody else who wants power. It's just that they want to be in control, they want to run the country, and they want to run it in their particular way. But they're just as much hypocritical as the people that rule them at the moment. So it's complex. You can't really say that there's a hatred of the English anymore, because anybody that might have disliked the English is now dead, and they would have disliked them simply because of what happened before the War of Independence, which was known as the Black and Tans War back in the early part of the 20th century. So most of the people who would have those memories have now died. And while there would be people who would be antagonistic towards the occupation of the six counties of Ireland as a result of what's been happening for the last 30, 40 years. Again, that's been dissipated considerably by politics. But again, it's the same kind of politics. It's the politics of power. So anyone that's got a vested interest in hating somebody else is missing the point.
Toliko torej v prvem delu oddaje o zgodovini irskega otoka in njegovih prebivalcev, ki se po skoraj 2000 letih bojevanja učijo živeti drug ob drugem. Ostanite z nami še naprej.
I'm not talking about time.
Industrializacija se je na otoku pospešeno uveljavila šele na polovici 20. stoletja, do takrat je bila Irska izrazito kmetijska država. Kmetijstvo tudi danes ostaja zelo pomembna pridobitvena panoga, saj se izključno s kmetovanjem še vedno ukvarja okoli 10% prebivalcev, ki prispevajo 7% in pol deleža vsega ustvarjenega nacionalnega BDP-ja. To pa je visoko nad povprečjem Evropske unije. V irsko tradicionalno kmetovanje sodijo predvsem pridelovanje krompirja, pšenice, ovsa in sladkorne pese. Močno razviti pa sta tudi ovčjereja in govedoreja. Pogoji za kmetovanje so na Irskem dokaj ugodni zaradi velikih količin dežja. Dežuje namreč okoli 11 mesecev na leto. Tako je Irska po svetu znana tudi kot zelena dežela. O tem smo se pogovarjali s priznanim ekologom Davidom Hilljem iz Dublina, ki je prepričan, da naziv zelena dežela v bistvu izvira še iz srednjeveških časov, ko so večino otoka prikrivali gozdovi, ki pa jih zdaj skoraj da več ni.
Previously Ireland was covered with forests and the process of deforestation started when the first people arrived continued throughout the prehistoric period. Then during the English colonization further deforestation was carried out, both for plantation to take over the land and also for military reasons in order to clear places that rebels were hiding in, and in a number of instances as well to fund smelters for industrial exploitation of mines and mining ores and so on.
Gozdovi trenutno na Irskem pokrivajo komaj 5% otoške površine, država pa zagato rešuje z umetnimi nasadi hitro rastočih iglavcev. Ribištvo je prav tako zelo pomembna pridobitvena dejavnost, ki še vedno zaposluje okoli 16 tisoč ljudi, vendar pa se, kakor tudi kmetijstvo, sooča z veliko krizo zaradi prestrukturiranja nacionalnega gospodarstva, ki poteka po neoliberalnih direktivah Evropske unije. Stari načini življenja vse bolj izginjajo, ker ne zagotavljajo več preživetja ali pa se umikajo pred interesi globalnega kapitala. Kljub visokemu gospodarskemu razvoju na Irskem v 90-ih letih prejšnjega stoletja, o čemer bomo govorili čez nekaj minut, je Irska ostala ena izmed manj razvitih evropskih držav.
Thank you.
Irska je bila leta 1949 sprejeta v Svet Evrope, leta 1973 pa je postala polnopravna članica Evropske gospodarske skupnosti, ki je kasneje zaplodila Evropsko unijo. Dan danes, po natanko 30 letih vstopa v EGS, velja Irska za zgodbo o uspehu in se prikazuje kot poduk vsem evroskeptikom in ostalim nevernim Tomažem, ki dvomijo v evropske integracijske procese. Z vstopom v Evropsko gospodarsko skupnost se je Irska hitro otresla gospodarske odvisnosti od Velike Britanije, ki je dotedaj stiskala Irsko v svojem ekonomskem obroču. Robert Allen pojasnjuje.
The benefits would have been greater to the 26 counties to the Republic of Ireland than they would have been to the north. Pretty much anyone that moved into the north had moved in before Britain and therefore Northern Ireland joined the EEC, now the EU. So for a moment, let's just concentrate on the South. The South benefited greatly simply because after the War of Independence and the break from Britain, it was part of the Commonwealth. But then in 1948, Éamon de Valera, who was the Taoiseach, which is the Irish word for Prime Minister or President, or not President, because that's a different role, but the man who was basically in control of leading the country, managed to get Ireland out of the Commonwealth, and it no longer became known as a free state, and it became known as a Republic of Ireland, so it had its own independence, it was free to go its own way. But it was in a very bad state. It had been an economic war which Britain had imposed on Ireland.
Mali zeleni otok je tako kmalo postal tarča globalnega kapitala, predvsem iz ameriških naftnih korporacij, ki so sprva vlagale zlasti v razvoj kemične in farmacevske industrije, medtem ko je Evropska gospodarska skupnost financirala razvoj kmetijstva. Vendar pa je Robert, kakor tudi mnogi drugi, danes prepričan, da denar ni bil porabljen tam, kjer bi bil najbolj potreben.
Before it joined the EU or the EC, in 1958, there was a policy put together, an industrial policy, to improve the quality of the country by simply inviting in the corporates from all over the world, particularly from America, and they would set up shop. And initially, the idea was that they would train the Irish to be good managers, and then the Irish could run their own factories. It didn't quite work out like that, and this is the major reason why America got such a grip on the country. So on one hand, you had the Americans bringing in their pharmaceutical and their chemical industries, and this started in 1958, and by the early 60s, the factories were starting to be built, particularly in the area around Cork Harbour. So by 1973, you had a very strong industrial base. But at the time, agriculture was impoverished, and it needed money, and that's where the EU came in, and the Irish government was able to, because it was seen as a peripheral state, as one of the poorer EU states at the time, it was able to ask the EEC for money for structural funds and for funds for all kinds of other activity, which would have included infrastructural funds to improve roads and to improve railways and to improve the public infrastructure generally. Now, that didn't really happen. What happened was that the Irish government used this money to basically run the state because it couldn't run it properly. So it needed this EU money. So the myth that exists that the Irish did very well out of the EU is not true. The people, the elites, the people who ran the country did very well out of the EU. And that is still the case. They still get money off the EU today. And that money still goes into the government coffers. It still goes into the government budget. And it's used basically to shore up what is a corrupt state. But what is it now? We're 2003, so 30 years down the line, agriculture, which should have benefited from being in the EU, has now become as impoverished as it was back in the 30s, and that people are being taken off the land and taken back into the factories. So there was a dual dependency. One was on the American corporates who were bringing their factories to Ireland, and one was on the EU. But the EU has benefited the Irish elites. It has not benefited the Irish people, and that's now being seen by the state of the economy in the country.
V 90-ih letih prejšnjega stoletja je Republika Irska dosegla izjemen ekonomski boom z 8-odstotno rastjo bruto domačega proizvoda na leto in tako postala najhitreje razvijajoče se gospodarsko območje v zahodnem svetu. Uradna nezaposlenost je padla na 5%. Samo v prvih 6 letih je ekonomski izvoz v Evropo in Severno Ameriko znašal 70% bruto domačega proizvoda. Leta 1998 se je tako Irska, glede na število prebivalcev, uvrstila na 3. mesto največjih izvoznikov v svetu, takoj za Singapurjem in Luksemburgom. Velik irski gospodarski razvoj so evropski tehnokrati poimenovali keltski tiger in ga postavljali za zgled uspeha novim kandidatkam, ki nestrpno čakajo pred vrati Evropske unije. Prvo vprašanje, ki bi ga bilo smiselno postaviti, je, zakaj se je ekonomski boom na Irskem zgodil šele v 90-ih letih, ko pa se je ta država pridružila evropskim kapitalističnim integracijam že leta 1973. Kaj pravzaprav res stoji za tako imenovanim keltskim tigrom? Robert Allen odgovarja.
This is an interesting debate, and it's a debate that's been ignored. There's been loads of books written about the Celtic tiger, and there's been a lot of analysis about the Celtic tiger. And particularly the question is, why did it happen when it did? Particularly when in 1984, 1985, 86, Ireland was in a pretty bad shape. Its inflation levels were off the chart. Unemployment was rising, and the cost of living was rising, and the country was in trouble. So, in the mid 80s, 10 years or so after joining the EU, you would have thought that the Irish economy would have been doing well, especially as at this stage it had something like 9 of the top 12 American corporates in chemical and electronic corporates established in the country. But of course all this money was leaving the country and it wasn't really benefiting it other than the benefit you get simply from wages being spread around the local economy. If you've got people earning $500 a week, for example, then that they would be spending that money in their local communities. But that doesn't really help the infrastructure of a country, and it certainly doesn't help solve problems which were caused by colonialization. So by the time this so-called economic boom, this so-called economic tiger began, people were scratching their heads and saying, well, it has to be to do with the fiscal policies of government. It has to be to do with the way the government have managed their affairs. Now, in that sense, that's entirely true. And it's got less to do with the corporates and less to do with the EU and much, much more to do with what the World Bank has imposed on Ireland as a post-colonial country in the same way that the World Bank has imposed policies on countries like Argentina and all the other countries in which, again, you can explain this separately. So to an extent, the major reason why the economic boom happened in the 1990s is because, pushed by the World Bank and by the other financial elites in the world, the Irish government went into partnership with the trade unions, who essentially betrayed the workers. And the deal was that they would not have any pay rises. And at the same time, the World Bank was encouraging the financial institutions in Ireland to make sure that people spent money that they didn't have. So they were encouraged to spend, therefore increasing the amount of money that was fluctuating in the commercial sectors, i.e. the high streets. So the banks were lending money to people and the price of houses were going up and the price of food was going up. But because people were being loaned money, they were spending it without thinking that there was going to be a payback.
V letih eksplozivnega gospodarskega razvoja so Irsko preplavila vlaganja tujih korporacij v njeno industrijo, tokrat predvsem v elektrotehnično. Združene države Amerike so na primer v Irsko vlagale 27% vseh svojih ekonomskih investicij v Evropsko unijo, oziroma, povedano drugače, obseg ameriških investicij v Irsko je znašal približno $3,000 na prebivalca, kar je precej več, kot znaša bruto družbeni proizvod na osebo v marsikateri nekateri tako imenovani državi drugega ali tretjega sveta. Kaj je torej zares privlačilo tuje multinacionalke, da so tako zauzeto vlagale v irski gospodarski prostor? Poglejmo si nekaj preprostih dejstev, ki poskušajo odgovarjati na zastavljeno vprašanje. Začnemo lahko s podatkom, da so irski delavci plačani dvakrat manj kot nemški. Na začetku 90-ih let je irska vlada po nasvetih Svetovne banke in Mednarodnega denarnega sklada sprejela celo vrsto davčnih olajšav in drugih ugodnosti za velike korporacije. Rojstvo in rast keltskega tigra so dolga leta spremljali politični škandali, ki so pričali o podkupovanju domačih vladnih politikov strani multinacionalnih korporacij. Večina zakonov, ugodnih za tuje investicije, je bila sprejeta tako rekoč pod mizo, za pravo vsoto denarja. Podrobnejša analiza keltskega tigra danes, ko je irsko gospodarstvo vse resnejši krizi, nam govori o tem, da je ekonomski boom koristil zgolj elitnim kapitalističnim slojem, predvsem tujim multinacionalnim korporacijam in ne irskim delavcem. Medtem, ko so v zadnjih 10 letih plače zaposlenih v industrijskem sektorju povprečju narasle za 10%, so davki narasli za 40%. Na drugi strani pa so multinacionalne korporacije svoje zaslužke povišale za neverjetnih 267%. Više davke irska vlada upravičuje s potrebo po gradnji nove infrastrukture, ki pa v končni fazi spet služi predvsem tujemu kapitalu. Vzporedno z davki so se v obdobju vzpona keltskega tigra višali tudi življenjski stroški. Drugo polovico 90-ih let je zaznamovala predvsem izjemno hitra rast cen nepremičnin. Leta 1989 je povprečna cena stanovanske hiše znašala nekaj več kot 11 povprečnih letnih plač delavcev, medtem ko 10 let kasneje znaša nekaj manj kot 20 letnih plač. Najemnine stanovanj so se zvišale za 15-20%, v okolici Dublina pa celo za 26%. Stanovanjski problem je seveda najbolj pereč med najrevnejšim in najbolj ranljivim delom populacije, kamor sodijo predvsem industrijski delavci, mlade družine in študentje. Nacionalna agencija za boj proti revščini je nedavno razburkala javnost s podatki, da skoraj 1/3 prebivalstva grozi revščina, obenem pa je Irska po stopni otroške revščine druga med državami Evropske unije. Irski gospodarski boom v obdobju keltskega tigra je torej vzpostavil tako imenovano dvotirno gospodarstvo, ki ga na eni strani zaznamujejo izjemno visoki zaslužki privilegiranih elit. Druga stran kovanca ni tako svetla. Čeprav se je število delovnih mest povečalo, nezaposlenost pa se je zmanjšala, pa nova delovna mesta omogočajo večinoma le delo s skrajšanim delovnim časom in dela, ki so vezana na začasne pogodbe. Obenem se je zmanjšala moč sindikatov in socialna varnost.
What you're talking about here is, I suppose, a classic example of advanced capitalism, but advanced capitalism that it benefits the elites, and the elites then therefore are able to come up with more schemes to make more money. But of course you cannot keep doing this indefinitely. It's not a finite resource that they're tapping here. Obviously they can tap people's resources to a certain extent, that people have to buy food, they have to have shelter, they have to have warmth and so forth. You can do this, but sooner or later it's going to start falling apart. So the short answer is that Ireland hasn't benefited, the Irish people have not benefited from the EU. in any particular way. But the elites have certainly benefited from it. And as for the Celtic Tiger phenomena, the Celtic Tiger phenomena has got nothing to do with the EU in a larger sense. It's a small factor, but certainly it's not the road to Damascus. It's not paved with gold. If you join the EU, you cannot hold Ireland up as a model and say, right, Ireland joined the EU in 1973, and now in the mid-90s and the early part of this century, that it has now benefited and everyone's going to benefit the same. What will happen is already happening in Eastern Europe, and that is that you end up with a two-tier economy, whereas the elites are quite well off. And by the elites, I don't mean the higher echelon. I mean the people who control industry, the people who control commerce, the people who control infrastructure, and the people who control food. They will be well off, but the rest of the people will be working for a pittance. So if you want to live that kind of life, then I recommend that you join the EU. But if you actually want to build a country that is dependent, culturally or politically or socially or economically, then joining the EU would be a complete and utter disaster, because then you just become pawns in the whole scheme of things, and that you'll probably find that your wages will start going down rather than up. But that's after the euphoria of thinking that there's more money there, because there will be an initial investment that will come as a result of being in the EU. But once that initial investment dies down, you'll find that the wages that you're being paid are just as low as the wages that you earn now.
Mnogi analitiki se v zadnjih letih sprašujejo, kako dolgo bo na Irskem vzdržala situacija, ki je omogočila rast keltskega tigra. Velike korporacije in multinacionalke, ki so pripomogle k usponu keltskega tigra, se namreč vse hitreje umikajo z irskega tržišča. Dober primer za to je korporacija Fruit of the Loom, katere tekstilni obrati so zaposlovali 5000 ljudi. V zadnjih letih se je proizvodnja pospešeno selila iz Irske v Maroko, saj je vodstvo ugotovilo, da mora delavcu na Irskem na teden plačati približno 200 funtov, medtem ko delavec v Maroku isto delo opravi za 30 funtov. Obenem bodo s širitvijo Unije na evropsko tržišče vstopile nove države, ki bodo zaradi slabše gospodarske razvitosti, podobno kot nekdaj Irska, bolj prijazne tujemu kapitalu, pa tudi stroški poslovanja bodo nižji. V naravi multinacionalnih korporacij je, da na nova tržišča vstopajo kot kvartopirci za mizo pokra, kjer si naberajo denarja in igrajo, dokler imajo dobiček. Ko postanejo soigralci izčrpani, pa se multinacionalke selijo za drugo kvartopirsko mizo, na novo hitro partijo pokra. We'll be right back. nadnacionalne organizacije in institucije, kot so Evropska unija, Mednarodni monetarni sklad in Svetovna banka, sponzoriranjem keltskega tigra niso zgolj pripomogle k zmanjševanju delavskih in socialnih pravic, temveč je neoliberalna tržna logika zavedno spremenila tradicionalni način preživljanja ljudi na Irskem. Irsko gospodarstvo je v preteklosti temeljilo na kmetijstvu in tradicionalnem izvažanju prehrambenih proizvodov ter živine, sedaj pa se temeljna gospodarska dejavnost celi iz delovno intenzivnih v kapitalsko intenzivne panoge, kot so na primer telekomunikacije in finančne storitve. Temelji irske ekonomije so se torej z vstopom v Evropsko unijo in prodorom kapitala multinacionalk ter mednarodnih finančnih institucij radikalno spremenili. Ena izmed nekdaj temeljnih gospodarskih dejavnosti, ki je z vstopom Irske v Evropsko unijo zašla v veliko krizo, je ribištvo. Decembra so ribiči organizirali enodnevno splošno stavko, s katero so hoteli opozoriti na nevzdržne razmere, v katerih so se znašli zaradi restriktivnih zakonov, ki jih je uvedla Evropska unija. Skupna evropska politika na področju ribolova namreč po temeljitem prestrukturiranju predvideva zmanjšanje ribiške flote. Irskim ribičem pa narekuje, da morajo radikalno zmanjšati ribolovne kvote, obenem pa klesti državne programe za subvencioniranje popravil starih in izgradnjo novih ribiških ladij. Po drugi strani se ribiči soočajo z močnim pritiskom okoljevarstvenega lobija, ki meni, da je potrebno omejiti ribolov in vzpostaviti posebna varovalna območja, da bi zaščitili ribe pred popolnim iztrebljenjem. Svoje videnje problematike nam je zaupal ekolog David Healy.
Well, starting at the last question, the fishing has been, you know, the fishing stocks have been overfished. And are in decline. Some fish certain species certainly are in collapse. So the question really is whether fishing stops now or whether they try and fish for another few more years and find that it's gone for good. And that's a very difficult situation for them to find themselves in. And it's also got to do with the structure of the European Union and the fact that Ireland's fish... have essentially, or the fish in the waters of Ireland, are primarily being fished out by fishermen from other countries, which is causing further resentment here amongst the fishing community. Howth then is dependent, I suppose, as a local business on fishing, but is primarily a suburb of Dublin, and has now the kind of the planning battles which that led to over the last 20 and 30 years are more or less over, and most of the area is now protected from any further urban development. So what we have is a very beautiful natural environment of the cliffs and the coastline, and then woods and so on, and further inside in the peninsula. The main pressure on the fishing stocks doesn't come from the small, quite small scale fishing, which is carried out by, you know, Irish small-scale Irish trawlers. Now, on the other hand, some of the Irish fishing is carried out by large factory trawlers. And in fact, the biggest trawler in the world belongs to an Irish fisherman or fishing company. And it's now been fishing in the waters of Mauritania, of Africa, and is essentially destroying the livelihoods of the local fishermen down there. So there's a question of, you know, the problem being displaced onto poorer and poorer people, and everybody's livelihoods being taken away.
Situacija je toliko bolj zapletena zato, ker je ribolov edini vir zaslužka za precejšnje število ljudi, predvsem na jugovzhodni obali otoka, kjer obstajajo tudi take obalne skupnosti, v katerih so 3/4 prebivalstva zaposlene v ribištvu oziroma v obratih za predelovanje rib. V primeru, da irska vlada od Evropske unije ne bo izposlovala boljših pogojev za svoje ribiče, jim grozi, da bo okoli 8000 ribičev, kar pomeni dobro polovico vseh ribičev na Irskem, ostalo brez dela.
selfish man. Selfish man.
Rastoča recesija v gospodarstvu in negotova prihodnost delavcev utegne sprožiti nove emigracijske valove iz Irske. Irska je sicer vedno slavela kot dežela, iz katere so se ljudje množično izseljevali, o čemer priča tudi podatek, da je še pred slabim desetletjem kar tretjina vseh mladih srednješolsko ali visokošolsko izobrazbo po končanem šolanju zapustila deželo in iskala službo v tujini. Razlog za izseljevanje je bil in je še vedno predvsem v pomankanju delovnih mest. Čeprav je vlada z mnogimi izobraževalnimi programi in javnimi deli navidezno zaposlovala ljudi in so uradne statistike prikazovale 20-odstotno nezaposlenost mladih, pa neodvisni analitiki menijo, da je stopnja nezaposlenosti precej višja. Na nekaterih območjih naj bi bilo tako med mladimi kar 50% brezposelnih. V zadnjih nekaj letih je Irska, podobno kot nekatere druge države Evropske unije in tiste na njeni periferiji, doživela emigracijski boom. Čeprav je število ljudi, ki se izseljujejo iz Irske, še vedno neprimerno večje, kot je število priseljencev. Kljub temu pa irska vlada namenja veliko več pozornosti tako imenovani imigrantski nevarnosti, namesto, da bi se posvečala urejanju notranjih ekonomsko-socialnih razmer, ki ljudi silijo k imigriranju. O omenjeni temi nam bo več povedala Ursula Fraser, ki dela kot komisarka za begunce pri irski sekciji organizacije Amnesty International.
Okay, well, mainly I work in the area of asylum, so I can tell you that there is roughly 10,000 asylum seekers coming per year in the last few years. In the early 1990s, we had maybe just a few hundred every year. So there has been quite a sharp increase. We've also had an increase of migrants, people here to work or study. We now take in thousands and thousands of people every year on work visas or student visas. So the entire immigrant population, with both categories included, is really quite significant now.
Irska vlada se je na imigracijski pritisk odzvala v skladu s smernicami skupne imigracijske politike Evropske unije, ki je šele v procesu nastajanja, vendar je že zdaj jasno, da ne bo temeljila na liberalni, temveč na restriktivni doktrini. Odločitev skupne evropske politike, da bo imigrantom zaprla vhodna vrata in bo vodila restriktivno imigracijsko politiko, pa povzroča nove probleme, saj se število tako imenovanih ilegalnih migrantov povečuje, kar se upada z upadom števila prosilcev za azil. O slabostih restriktivnih imigracijskih politik je Uršula povedala naslednje.
The problem from my point of view is the whole area of protection for asylum seekers and the overlap with illegal immigration. So the big problem that I have is that the government is introducing a lot of restrictive policies which are aimed to tackle illegal immigration, but in fact have an adverse effect on asylum seekers. So just to give you an example, you have this carrier's liability, carrier sanctions, that will be introduced in the Immigration Act of 2002. And the Parliament is due to hear that on Wednesday. So carrier sanctions are fines imposed on airlines and ferry companies for allowing undocumented passengers to travel. But the problem is that in international refugee law, it's acknowledged that asylum seekers sometimes have to travel without the correct documentation when they are fleeing certain situations. So this type of legislation clearly will create a more restrictive environment, and it will make it harder for asylum seekers to get into Ireland. I mean, carrier sanctions are in every other European Union country apart from Sweden, I think. So it will make it harder for asylum seekers to get into Ireland, and as a result, they will have to be reduced to clandestine methods. So last year we had a tragedy in Wexford, which is on the east coast of Ireland, where 8 Turkish people were killed. They suffocated in a container on their way to Wexford. So groups like Amnesty International would be very worried about carrier sanctions insofar as they are yet another restrictive measure which closes the gates even more to asylum seekers, which creates more opportunities for smugglers and traffickers and agents who charge money to facilitate the travel of asylum seekers.
V okviru nacionalne politike boja proti tako imenovanim ilegalnim imigrantom je Irska sledila smernicam, ki jih je predtem zastavila že Velika Britanija. V okviru imigrantskega zakona, ki je bil sprejet v parlamentu konec lanskega leta, so uvrstili člen, ki določa, da se morajo prosilke in prosilci za azil prijaviti ustreznim oblastem na meji takoj po vstopu v državo. Zakon nadalje omogoča, da se tistim prosilcem in prosilkam za azil, ki vložijo prošnjo za odobritev azila v notranjosti države, avtomatično odvzame državna podpora in subvencije, ki bi jih sicer bili po zakonu deležni. Številne irske organizacije, ki se ukvarjajo z begunci in azilanti, so opozorile na pomankljivosti omenjenega zakona, saj so izrazile skrb, da bi bili prosilci in prosilke za azil avtomatično zavrnjeni že na meji in deportirani v državo, iz katere so vstopili na Irsko. Uršula je obenem pojasnila, da nevladne organizacije skrbi tudi pomankanje nadzora nad postopki, katerim so azilanti podvrženi na mejah.
Well, certainly there is no transparency at Irish borders, whether they're seaports or airports. You simply have immigration officials. There's no independent body which gives advice on the law or social welfare entitlements or anything like that. And a number of people are turned back every year at the border. And of course, the government says that these people don't claim asylum, that they would never turn an asylum seeker back. But we only have their word for it. And certainly there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that people who are here already, their family members, are expected in on planes or in ships, and that they know that they have arrived, but they also know that they have been turned back. And the families here know that the people travelling wanted to claim asylum. So there's a contradiction there. So we don't really know how many asylum seekers or potential asylum seekers are turned back at the ports, because there's nobody really monitoring it, and certainly the government are not going to tell us that they turn back any asylum seekers. And of course, you have no power when you're at a border. If you're in somebody else's country and you have no documents, you have absolutely no power whatsoever. And that if you do anything that's disruptive, you know that you could be put into jail. So people are not going to run that risk, and they will just turn around and do whatever the authorities tell them to do.